From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. We're going noir this hour with a show on crime fiction, the one literary taste that crosses every border and every nationality. From Denmark to Spain, Israel to Africa, you can tell a lot about a country from its taste in detectives and dead bodies.
When you put a corpse in a novel, it's an excuse to talk about other things.
I think with this sort of a genre, I can be as graphically violent as the story needs, actually, and be as graphically violent as reality.
We'd love to be the detective who solves everything. We'd like to think we are that capable.
If your taste in reading runs to blood spatter and bullet holes, there's a whole new world of crime fiction out there. We all know Nordic noir, but now crime fiction's going worldwide. Barry Forshaw keeps an eye on the international literary crime scene from England, where he edits the website Crime Time. He was one of the first to notice the Nordic noir movement, and he's just finished a new book on Euro noir. Anne Strainchamp's caught up with him.
Barry, it has been kind of exciting to see how international crime fiction has become in the past few years. What's happening?
Well, it actually always has been international. It's just that we didn't notice it. Certainly in this country, we read Georges Simenon, and we thought that the writer just has the misfortune to be born in Belgium. He's really British. But then everything began to change, really, with Henning Mankell and Stieg Larsson, when the Scandinavian wave started to break over our heads.
But that's kind of just the tip of the iceberg, right?
It is, but it was a kind of critical mass syndrome. So first of all, you had Henning Mankell and his Wallander, or Wallander as he's called in the British version. And then, as you correctly say, this explosion happened, this juggernaut, which was Stieg Larsson with the Lisbeth Salander. And by that time, various shows like The Killing, they made a bigger impact in Britain than they did in America, where, of course, you had your own version.
It really is sort of astonishing when you think half of England stays up to watch this Danish TV show, The Killing, subtitled in English. That's phenomenal, don't you think?
It's not only that. This strange syndrome has happened, which I've noticed recently. People now at dinner parties or the water cooler moment, they spend their time apologising for not having seen The Killing. So it's become kind of fashionable and de rigueur to watch these things.
Right. These have become must-sees. Well,
they are.
Beyond Nordic noir, there's an entire European continent of crime fiction waiting to be discovered by American and British readers. I know you've been surveying this for a new book on Eurocrime. Give us a sense of, you know, the international range.
Well, I think it's interesting that when I was writing Euro Noir, I looked at the countries which had a kind of the sense that something was really happening, something big. For a long time, it was Italy. And you had writers like Camilleri, his Montalbano series is made into a very popular TV series over here. Then you had France, which has a particularly healthy selection of writers at the moment. There's a woman writer called Fred Vargas, whose books are eccentric. They seem in some ways like Agatha Christie-type mysteries, but with something wrong, there's a screw loose, there's something missing. And they have a tremendous sense of France and the French sensibility.
Now, what about if we head over to Germany? Who are the big stars there?
There's a writer called Nele Neuhaus, who is phenomenally popular. Snow White Must Die is the kind of breakthrough novel. It's about a young man coming back to his country town, and he's been convicted of a crime which he may or may not have committed. And this crime has had terrible repercussions on his family. The problem we've got when I'm talking to you like this now is that you can only say so much about them because you don't want to give any revelations.
You can't give it away. So every writer is different, of course, but are there general national characteristics that distinguish, you know, German crime fiction from, say, French crime fiction?
Yes, I think there is with French crime fiction, there's a certain playfulness, there's a certain Gallic whimsy, which you will find in a lot of the French crime writers. In the Italians, and this is quite interesting for the British, we love to look at the series adapted from the books, and we like to read the books, which all have this Italianate warmth, and everything is slightly laid back. But we in Britain don't quite respond to that. We think that's not really the real world. The reason we like the Scandinavians is because it's a cold climate, just like Britain. They have a fairly phlegmatic, not so much gloomy, but what we would consider to be a realistic view of the world. And we feel that that's the real thing.
The detectives in Nordic fiction, you know, they're usually on the grim side. They're all these introverted, depressed, alcoholic, divorced detectives. Are the Mediterranean detectives a generally happier
bunch?
No,
you see, now that's quite interesting. The Mediterraneans, like Montalbano, have good sex lives. They eat a lot of excellent food. They're always sitting in one of their favorite restaurants where the maitre d' always knows their name and knows what they like. And behind them is the ocean. But we know it's not real. And we do want damaged coppers nowadays.
Why do you think that is? Why do we want our heroes troubled?
Because perhaps vicariously, we want and don't want the kind of life they have. We love to be the detective who solves everything. We'd like to think we are that capable. Also, you have to say that it is often in crime films, it used to be, the policemen were rather dull just solving the cases. So now one way to make the policeman interesting is to give him just as much character and just as many problems as any of the criminals have.
Hmm. You know, reading crime fiction, one of the great things about reading crime fiction is that it can be a way to get a kind of inside view of the social or political issues in another country. So what kind of issues do you see, for instance, German crime writers writing about?
Well, in the terms of the German crime writers, as yet, it's just really what could be applicable to America and Britain, which is the corruption beneath the surface of an ordered town, quite often small towns, in which everything seems to function okay and everybody is happy and they get on. Needless to say, this conceals some heinous crime that was committed, usually far in the past. Crime fiction of many of the foreign countries is about something from the past coming back to affect the present.
Do you think that has to do with the sort of echoes from World War II or Germany's Nazi past?
That is, in fact, not so much the Germans, although they do talk about it, but as the Scandinavians. So Joe Nesbø, his books are about the legacy of the wartime past and the slightly tricky relationship that some of the occupied countries have. Joe, for instance, talks about the fact that his own father fought on the side of the Germans in Norway and was obliged to apologize for this. So this is, it's still a hot potato for many of the Scandinavian countries.
But this reminds me of something I think you wrote about. Somebody said to you, one of the great reasons to read crime fiction is if you're traveling to another country, read a crime novel from that country. It will tell you much more about the country than a travel guide would.
It's absolutely true. Invariably, a crime writer is trying to make his or her country interesting.
So I was thinking more about the risk of romanticizing another culture. You know, whether you would, if you're translating, you know, Swedish fiction for an American audience, I would guess there's the temptation to make it conform to our romantic stereotypes of what Sweden should be like.
You've actually got it in one when you say that, and Valanda is the way to look at that. So Valanda, the Swedish, two Swedish series, show you this flat, urban Sweden. This is not the tourist Sweden, it's council estates, it's factories. It's not at all beautiful, and it feels even set in the rather beautiful little town of Ustad, which is Henning Mankell's setting. It's not made to look beautiful. Now, when the Brits go over and make Wallander, as they now called it, with Kenneth Branagh, everything is exquisitely beautiful. And you're absolutely right, it is romanticized.
Barry, if we want to travel on beyond the, I don't know, the standard European countries, the Northern European and then the Middle European, what if we head even further south? Spain, Greece, Turkey? Is there crime fiction in those countries as well?
There are some terrific writers, but there's definitely fewer books in those countries. There's good crime writing coming from Japan, from China, from Russia, which is not Europe, of course, but nevertheless. Personally, I think anybody who loves crime fiction should spread their net as widely as they possibly can.
Barry Forshaw is the editor of the crime fiction website Crime Time and the author of Nordic Noir. His new book, Euro Noir, will be out this spring. If there's one show that's put international crime fiction on the map recently, it's The Killing. The Danish TV show is a sensation in Great Britain, where millions of viewers have watched it obsessively in the original Danish. The Killing, or in Danish, Forbrydelsen, has inspired such fanatical devotion. Sales of Nordic sweaters like the one worn by the show's detective Sarah Lund have gone through the roof. An American remake aired on AMC, but to get the full flavor of the original, Steve Paulson tracked down screenwriter and producer Søren Sveistrup.
Søren, Forbrydelsen, or The Killing, has been described as the best crime series in the world. But for an American audience that hasn't yet caught the show, can you fill us in on what we're missing?
Actually, the idea of Forbrydelsen was pretty simple and banal. At the time, I was pretty provoked by all the other shows. I'm a big crime fan, of course, but crime show fan, but many shows, they depict crime as and murder as a kind of industry, you know, one episode, one serial killer, and the killer is caught, and then we move on to next episodes. And I got bored with that. So I wanted to show that the you could do actually a lot of drama with just one murder, one killing.
So what you're interested in is not just trying to solve the murder, but the fallout from the killing, including the fallout for the family, for the parents of the
exactly.
girl who's been killed.
Yes, I wanted to show the and focus on the human consequences, actually. So I wanted to see if I could depict the world's strongest family, actually, the world's strongest family, and then to see them try to survive this terrible crime. We did a lot of research on the on actual killings in Denmark and abroad, and unfortunately, of course, the relatives, the families, they have a lot of fights and struggles afterwards. Their lives change very, very abruptly, and their destinies are totally different from before the incident.
God aften, det er fra Kriminalpolitiet. Jeg hedder Sara Lund. Jeg skulle egentlig tale med deres nabo, Gertsen. Ved de, hvor hun er?
Can you describe your central detective, Sarah Lund? How is she different from other detectives who've come before her?
I don't know if she's different, but she's definitely has become an icon of great interest. She's not especially a female detective. Actually, she's more thought of as a kind of alien from outer space, you know. She fell to Earth, and now she has to deal with humans. And she's socially handicapped, you could say. I mean, she doesn't really listen when people are talking to her. She doesn't really, you know, even though it's her only son talking to her. And she can't really relate in many respects to socially.
Well, and the other thing that I'm struck by is how you depict Sarah Lund, just visually. I mean, she doesn't wear sexy clothes as many American detectives would wear. In fact, she has this trademark sweater that she always wears, and I understand that it's become a phenomenon.
Yes,
her sweater.
No, because, you know, at the time when we started out, every show had this female detective in high heels, and while she was solving the cases, actually, she was also dating the forensic guy, you know, and I thought, this can't be done. So, of course, Sophie Grubbel is amazingly attractive, so maybe that's why we can do it. I mean, you can lock her in a box, you can turn out the light, and there will still be a special glow, you know, around her and the box, and so it was easy to dress her down. I mean, we really dressed her down. And then Sophie had a good idea. She said, okay, if I'm that much my own person, my own character, maybe I could walk like a man. So she tried it to, you know, instead of walking female like females.
And, what does it mean to walk like a man?
You know, you can walk as a woman, a female detective, as you said before. You walk very, you know, elegantly, and you don't stumble, you don't fall, you don't you have etiquette. You know what to say in big crowds. Maybe your hair is always right, and we just wanted to do the opposite. So every time we thought now you're too good looking, and we stopped, and then we rearranged things, and walk like a man. It means like a farmer, maybe, or like John Wayne. I mean, a good old cowboy.
I think I've just discovered the secret of your TV show. You've created a modern John Wayne, but as a woman in Copenhagen.
or Clint Eastwood. I mean, I'm a great fan of Clint Eastwood. So we talked a lot about Clint Eastwood and also about spaghetti westerns because we wanted to have, you know, whole, that whole feeling in an urban way, you could say.
Jeg hører, at bilen hører under Troels Hartmanns kontor.
Ja, de har lejet den. Indtil videre, det er vores vigtigste spor, ja.
Hey, elsking.
Hi, Bing. Undskyld.
Now, I'm struck by some of the things that you've said that you wanted to do, to dig into with your television show, The Killing. I mean, talk about, explore family, love, vengeance, grief.
Yes.
I mean, these are the subjects of great literature, of course. And I guess I'm wondering if there are certain advantages of playing this out in the crime genre.
Actually, when I think about how we started out, I wanted to do something more novel-like. I just, you know, realized that if you take TV seriously, I think it has a lot of resemblance to a novel, actually. It's not like this was actually easy to do in Denmark because a lot of people, they said, how can the audience deal with the a crime story that actually goes on in so many episodes? But today, you know, people are saying, okay, that was good. I mean, we needed that. We were tired of, you know, all the one episode stuff too. So I think it's okay in some respects to compare the opportunities of a television show to a novel.
No, I have to ask you about Danish television in general, because it's really hot right now. I mean, around the world, and not just your show, The Killing, but The Bridge, Borgen, the upcoming 1864. I mean, these are catching on fire around Europe and starting to catch on in the United States. What's going on with Danish TV? Why is it so hot?
Well, Denmark and Norway, Sweden, we haven't been on the map, so to speak, that much. So there's a special feeling about these territories now. And of course, we are a bit strange compared to many other countries because we have this welfare system. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe that social awareness has been also a gift for many writers and directors. And I think that's... You get a different flavor in the international market, and I think we need that. I mean, in a few years, maybe it will be, I don't know, Colombia or Bolivia, you know, that kind of flavor. You never know.
Yeah. And one thing that's striking about not only your show, but a lot of these other Danish TV shows is there seems to be a great deal of interest in border crossings. I mean, even your show, The Killing, it takes us into Norway in season 3. Mm-hmm. What's going on here, do you think? Well, why this fascination with crossing borders?
It has to do with the everybody thinking global. I mean, I'm thinking global, but then again, we are very, very, you know, we feel very strongly for our local situation, for our places, our residences, and that is very much the case in Denmark because of the weather. I think. I mean, if you've seen the Killing, you would understand why, because it's always rainy. And in fact, we only have you know, maybe 1 month a year, and it's November. And every month is November, actually. But of course, also even the Danes wants to cross borders. And but normally we stay indoors, you know, in our IKEA homes. I think, you know, that's why we love IKEA that much, because of the weather. We have to stay inside. But, you know, sometimes, and even Saarlund has the courage to cross borders. And, you know, you always love that when characters, they have the courage to do that.
Steve Paulson talked with Søren Sveistrup, the screenwriter and producer of the Danish TV series Forbrydelsen. The American remake is called The Killing, but hold out for the original. We're talking about having the courage to cross borders as readers in this hour. Crime fiction from India, Israel, Spain, and Africa when we come back. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Crime fiction may seem like a light read, perfect for a plane ride or some time at the beach, but writers around the world are using the noir formula to tackle important social issues. In India, Kishore Desai takes on gender inequality and violence against women in her crime novel Witness the Night. Her detective, Simran Singh, is a social worker sent into a small town in northern India to help a young girl accused of killing her family.
I thought I'd never do this again, but when I read about this case, it intrigued me, because it was in my hometown, Jalandhar. I had a very good idea what it was like to grow up as a small-town girl, and I thought I could understand Durga better than most people. I thought I could perhaps help her cope with her distress. Could she really have killed 13 people in one night? All of them had been poisoned, some were slashed with a knife, and few were half-heartedly burnt. As my mind sifts through the various possibilities, I know that Durga's case fascinates me. The name itself is so apt. Durga, the fiery, many-armed goddess whose capacity for blood and mayhem is pure mythological theater. However, the Durga I've come to examine in Jalandhar's overcrowded jail seemed terribly insecure and rather vacuous, and so young. Now, lying in bed in the stuffy guest house early in the morning, I can still hear her voice, muffled by grief and perhaps an inability to grasp the cards that life has dealt her. For the first time in my life, I doubt my ability to deal with the situation. Does she remind me of myself at 14, confused and depressed? Could I ever have killed another person? I stub out my cigarette and try to sleep. The important thing is to remember to organize some liquor if I'm going to stay on here. I should have brought some in my suitcase from Delhi.
An excerpt from Indian writer Kishore Desai's debut crime novel, Witness the Night. And now let's head to Israel to meet the man behind one of the few detective stories written in Hebrew.
He stared at his computer screen, waiting for the right moment. "Do you know why there are no detective novels in Hebrew?" he then asked. "What? Why aren't there any detective novels? Why doesn't Israel produce books like those of Agatha Christie or The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?" "I don't read much," she replied.
Avi Avraham is the detective in Israeli novelist D.A. Mishani's notable crime fiction debut, The Missing File. In addition to writing novels, Mishani teaches detective fiction at Tel Aviv University. But is it really true there's no detective fiction in Israel?
It's partly true. Hebrew literature is, in general, is very young. It started only something like 150 years ago. The project of Hebrew literature was always very ideological and connected to the project of reviving the Jewish nation. And so literature, Hebrew literature, was always very serious. So writing in genres, not just crime, but also science fiction, for example, hardly existed.
I understand the need to revive the Hebrew language. You'd think, then, that one of the ways to encourage people to read Hebrew would be to publish literature that people would really want to read. And, I mean, frankly, serious literature is not always the first choice.
Exactly. And this is fascinating because the people who tried to promote crime fiction, they said, listen, this is what people will read. Let's translate Arthur Conan Doyle and let just the children read Sherlock Holmes so they'll learn Hebrew and not run away to read Sherlock Holmes in Yiddish under the table.
Well, I understand that, and it makes some sense to me. At the same time, Sherlock Holmes stories are not, I think, kids' stories.
Exactly. This is, you know, I remember one of the first experiences I have as a reader is reading at, I think, 8 years old, The Hound of the Baskervilles. And I remember I was terrified.
Yeah?
And I clearly remember reading all of the Holmes' stories available. And then from Holmes, I switched immediately to Agatha Christie. And I remember clearly one of, again, an important moment in my own private history as a reader, the moment where I finished the last Agatha Christie novel that we had in our library. And I remember not knowing, so what am I going to read now? I just want to read, you know, more stories with this detective character. It doesn't matter if it's Holmes or Poirot or even Miss Marple, but I want this detective character. So this was really clearly like a moment where I stopped reading detectives for quite a few years because, you know, there weren't many.
I think it's time to be introduced to your detective, Avraham. Who is he? What is he like?
Okay, he's in the beginning of the series, in the first novel, The Missing File. He's 30 years old. He works for the Holon Police Department. Holon is a suburb of Tel Aviv, a middle-class or low-middle-class urban suburb of Tel Aviv. He's considered to be a good officer, but he's not very high-ranked. And the case that he gets starts as a minor case, in a way. It's a, you know, disappearance of a 16-year-old boy.
You've laid the foundation for this, I think, by giving him a partial story that isn't obvious at the beginning about his hobby. Would you set up this reading for us? He's talking
He's talking to Marianka. She's a Belgian police officer that he meets in Belgium, where he goes for a week of police training. What do you do when you're not a policeman? She asked, and he said, I'm a policeman then too. It made her laugh. Even on weekends, don't you have any hobbies, like karate, perhaps? Actually, I do have a secret hobby that very few know about. I like to read crime novels when I have the time and watch crime movies and television series and prove the detectives wrong. She didn't understand. No one understood. Prove to whom? To myself. With every crime novel I read, I conduct my own investigation and prove that the detective in the book is mistaken or else deliberately misleads the readers and that the true solution is not the one he presents.
What is he talking about? You're saying that Agatha Christie and other detective novelists mislead us?
Yes. You mentioned that I'm teaching a course on the history of detective fiction. And when I did that, I discovered while reading again and again the same crime stories and the same crime novels, I discovered that every crime story and every crime novel had a different solution to them. And the true solution was like hidden from the readers and was written, if you want, behind the detectives' backs or something.
So did you take that to heart as you began to write The Missing File? Did you want to make Avi's solution to this mystery subject to doubt?
Yes, and in fact, I think something like that happened to me in a way. I wrote the novel, and when I wrote it, I had the solution in mind. And then when I finished the novel, I couldn't take the solution. I told myself, listen, you can't have this as this is not the right solution. There must be another solution. And I didn't know what to do. In fact, it took me weeks. And I was, you know, the novel was practically finished. And I sat every day in front of the computer waiting for another solution to appear. And it did appear. In fact, the novel has, I would say, two solutions. One that I premeditated and planned, and one that one of the characters, in fact, Marianka, this Belgian police officer, she brought the new solution to me. I was completely taken by surprise, and I think this is the true solution, but maybe there is another solution that I don't see in the novel.
You know, the unsatisfactory part of that from a reader's point of view is that part of the pleasure of reading mysteries is to get to the end and have it fixed, unlike the real world.
I know. I think that this is crucial. The fact that the end, you know, the solution is not completely clear, because I think that it leaves the reader with, you know, with questions. Not just questions about, who did it, but what really happened there. These are the questions that I think the reader should, you know, remain with after finishing a crime novel.
You're very enthusiastic about crime as literature. What do you think it brings to literature?
I'll tell you, you know, I want to be particular about that and tell you what it brings to Israeli literature. For example, Israeli literature was written mainly about Tel Aviv, Jerusalem, and the kibbutzim, the classic central symbolic spaces of Israeli culture. What was neglected there by Israeli literature is the suburbs. And so, for example, my novel that takes place in Holon, the suburb of Tel Aviv, is probably one of the first novels in Hebrew literature to take place in Holon. Holon is, you know, is a very big city in Israeli terms, not much smaller than Tel Aviv, but it never interested anybody in literature because, you know, it doesn't have any symbolic importance. You know, it's not very religious and it's not very secular. It's not part of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. So this attention to spaces and people and social problems, crime fiction can look at. And I think it was the case in the States too. I mean, if you think about noir fiction and what writers like Chandler and Hammett did in the 30s, taking literature, bringing it into the streets. This is something that, you know, crime fiction does, for example.
This is the literature of real life.
Yeah.
D.A. Mishani's novel, The Missing File, is the first in a new crime fiction series set in Israel. The next will be out this spring. We reached him in Tel Aviv. We're talking about international crime fiction this hour, and we've mentioned a lot of novels by men. What about crime fiction by women? One of Japan's best-known writers is Natsuo Kirino. Her hard-boiled psychological thriller, Real World, tracks the inner lives of five teenagers in the midst of social isolation and crass commercial culture.
I rushed into the classroom in my cram school for top-tier private colleges. Four people who looked like college students, two guys and two girls, were standing in front of the blackboard, smiling at the students seated in front of them. One of the girls spoke up. "Now's the time you've got to do your best and don't let yourself give up. There's still time. It's only the beginning of August." The spring I became a senior in high school, I was told to forget about getting into the university I was hoping for. "It'll never happen," they told me. But no exaggeration, that summer I spit up blood. I never worked so hard in my life. And I got into the Japan Academy of Arts. So I want you to give it everything you've got. We're going to come around to each of you. Feel free to ask us anything. What did she mean, study like you're going to die? She said she spit up blood, but is that for real? Is studying really worth dying for? The sense of danger we all feel is something my mother can't comprehend. My mom's generation still believes in beautiful things like justice and considering other people's feelings. But since we were little kids, we've been exposed to calls from people trying to get us to hire tutors or cram schools trying to get us to enroll after phony free counseling sessions. Walk around Tokyo and all you see are people trying to sell you something. Some old guy pats you on the shoulder, and before you know what hits you, you're in a hotel room. Stalkers' victims, the ones they kill, are always women. When the media was going nuts over schoolgirls getting old guys to be their sugar daddies for sex, that was the time when high school girls like us had the highest price as commodities. It sucks. It totally and absolutely sucks.
An excerpt from writer Natsuo Kirino's Japanese thriller Real World. When we come back, we'll talk with one of Spain's best-known crime writers. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're exploring the world through international crime fiction in this hour. Teresa Zelana writes stories set in one of the world's most beautiful cities, Barcelona. But her whimsical, satirical novels take us off the tourist beat and into everyday Catalan culture. Her most recent book is called The Sound of One Hand Killing, and strange chants reached her in Barcelona.
Teresa, tell us about your detectives, Eduard and Borja. They're brothers, but they're not very alike.
Well, in fact, they are twins, not only brothers, but they are not identical twins. Borja is a handsome man. He is conservative. He likes beautiful women, expensive cars. And on the other hand, his brother is left-wing. He's a family man. And they don't like each other very much.
Well, one of my first impressions from reading your novel is your detectives, these brothers, are so likable. You know, if you read Scandinavian noir today, the detectives are all these gloomy, divorced, haunted, alcoholic detectives.
Yeah.
And, you know, in your books, Eduard is a family man, Borja is a social climber. But they're both these friendly, normal, everyday kind of people. Are you trying to bring a lighter touch to noir fiction?
No, I think this is because my detectives are not policemen. So they are not living in the middle of crime all the time, no? They just found a corpse or found themselves having to investigate murder from time to time. But they are normal people.
See, I had a different theory. I thought, oh, maybe it has to do with the climate. I mean, this is Barcelona. The weather is beautiful. Everyone's always going out to eat tapas and drink cocktails. They have long siestas and weekends at the beach. So I thought, oh, this is Mediterranean noir.
Well, probably we have a different perspective of life, no, from people of the north. So if you live in a city when you can walk, when the sun is still 8, 9 o'clock in the evening and you can walk and see the sun, that gives to you a completely different perspective of life than if you live in a country when at 3 o'clock is dark.
Some of it's weather, but that difference between the northern and southern European cultures is so marked. You know, you could also say, well, those northern countries, those are the Calvinist Protestant countries. Mm. There's a long history of salvation through work. Whereas the Catholic Mediterranean countries, there's a bit more emphasis on celebration of life.
And in Catholic countries, you found hypocrisy. Because probably Catholic societies are most intolerant and people need a way to escape to that. I mean, Catholic societies are very tolerant if, for instance, you have a lover but you are a family man, blah, blah, blah. And I think in northern societies, people is not so tolerant with these lies. But on the other hand, we have a big, big problem in Mediterranean societies, that it's corruption.
So the challenge for your detectives is figuring out which lies are important and which lies are not.
Yeah, of course. I mean, if you're a politician and you have a lover, we are not interested in Mediterranean countries, in this kind of things. But if you have a lover and you pay her flat with the money of all of us, that's a problem. And the problem is that now, in the last years, we are discovering a lot of cases of corruption, a big corruption in Spain. No? And corruption is one of the factors of the economic crisis as well.
Well, so for people who are not all that familiar with the economic crisis in Europe, especially in how it affects people's daily lives, can you give us some background? I mean, how is the economic crisis playing out in Barcelona today?
Well, it's terrible. I'm not sure if it's so terrible as in other parts of Spain in this case, but the economic crisis has beaten us dramatically, and is especially dramatically for people that has lost their houses, that has no possibility to find a job anymore for the weak, mm-hmm. the weak people of the society, you know, the immigrants, mm-hmm. women, of course.
Can you talk a little bit more about your choice to focus on Catalan and how it shows up in your writing?
Well, in my case, Catalan is my mother tongue. I was 13 when Franco, the dictator, died. So that means that I grew up in Catalan at home and with my friends, but in Spanish at school and in public places.
And Franco tried to wipe out the Catalan identity, didn't he?
Yeah, and it's the same that is happening nowadays. Mm. Yeah, we are living again the old times of Franco. I think Spain never has understand that this country that we call Spain is a mix of different cultures and identities. It's not just the Spain of the Castilian, of the toreros and flamenco, no?
Do you see writing murder mysteries as really kind of a pretext for talking about Catalan society today?
Yeah, it is. It is. In my novels, the crime, the murder, it's an excuse to talk about other things. Because when you put a corpse in a novel, you need to begin an investigation to solve the crime. And that allows you to explain things that sometimes are hidden in your society, especially in the case of the rich people.
Teresa, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Teresa Solana's most recent crime novel is called The Sound of One Hand Killing. And now a story that begins literally across borders, in a plane, traveling from this country to Kenya.
A beautiful young blonde was dead, and the suspect was an African male. I was traveling to Africa in search of his past. What I found there would either condemn or save him. As you can imagine, my business was urgent. How many times had I thought of Africa? Not many, I'm afraid. Yes, I knew of Africa. After all, it was the land of my ancestors, a place I vaguely longed for without really wanting to belong to it. I might as well say it here. Coming from the U.S., there was a part of me that had come to believe Africa was a land of wars, hunger, disease, and dirt, even as my black skin pulled me towards it. So how many times had I thought of Africa? Not many, not in a real way. The funny thing, though, was, now that I was actually in a plane on my way to Africa, I found myself surrounded by whiteness, the passengers, the crews, and the pilots. I looked outside. Watching the full moon hover in the sky beyond the tip of the aeroplane wing, and below I saw what looked like an island of lights engulfed by perfect darkness. Then we landed, and everyone clapped. I was tired and a little tipsy from the complimentary Budweisers the crew had offered me. And so it was that, a little bit drunk, I took my first steps in Africa.
Makoma Wagugi is one of a new generation of transnational African writers. Born in the U.S., but raised in Kenya, his novels deal with the politics of race and class across international borders. His books include Nairobi Heat and Black Star Nairobi. Steve Paulson tracked him down.
Makoma, the opening pages of your first novel, Nairobi Heat, are set in Africa, but the plot, the crime, actually starts in Madison, Wisconsin. Do you consider this a Kenyan novel, or is it a transnational novel, or do these distinctions even matter?
I don't, you know, I tend to think of it more personally. I think of it as my novel. But definitely, I would say it fits in a trend of transnational African literature. You know, there is a group of us who are born in African countries and then lived in the U.S., or in my case, vice versa. I was born in the U.S., but lived in Kenya for half my life before coming back. So there are ways in which really my imagination draws freely from Kenya and also the U.S.
Well, your central character in these detective stories is this detective named Ishmael. How would you describe him?
I would describe him as a person who worries about his place in the world, but also very, very much worried about the nature of justice. He's really a good guy who finds himself in very extreme situations, and sometimes he has to act against his conscience.
And he's always a bit of an outsider, an African-American man who's never been to Africa, who's probably never thought about it that much, but then suddenly finds himself dealing with this very different culture.
Yeah, the question of Africans and African Americans, because of my own, the way I grew up in both places, has been very central to my imagination. I had some Black American friends in the early 90s who went to Kenya as part of the study abroad program. They were hoping Kenya to be welcoming, because of the shared Blackness, and a shared history in this case, of slavery and colonialism. But when they got there, people started calling them Mzungu. A Mzungu is a term, it's a Kiswahili name for a white person. And they ended up being so distraught that they left Kenya early.
Hmm. What you're doing in these crime novels is so fascinating because you're dealing with complicated political worlds, social dynamics, racial dynamics, in detective stories. And so obviously you're sort of playing on this tradition of the crime novel. And so I'm wondering how you see that. I mean, how does your detective Ishmael fit into sort of this long tradition of cops in crime stories?
Well, I mean, intellectually I've always been interested in popular fiction and popular literature. I've been influenced by Walter Mosley, whose most famous novel is Devil in a Blue Dress, that features an African-American detective. And in his novels, he does something very interesting. He's able to take this genre that traditionally, belong to people like Raymond Chandler, a genre that spoke for whiteness in a way. So and he's able to take it and bring in issues of identity, of racism. So I wanted to do something similar.
But you could have done this in a different kind of literary novel. I guess I'm wondering why this genre of crime fiction?
Oh, because you can do so much with it. I like to think of it as having endless possibilities. For example, in Blackstone, Nairobi, and also Nairobi Heat, actually, I've seen critics call them very, very violent. I think with this sort of a genre, I can be as graphically violent as the story needs, actually be as graphically violent as reality. And I think with realist fiction, there's always, even though you might be writing about genocide, I think there's something that's supposed to be pleasant,
right?
About realist fiction.
Well, and then to make things even more interesting, we should mention your father, who's a very famous Kenyan writer, Ngugi Wa-Thiong'o, who is very well known for his advocacy of work written in indigenous African languages. And here you are writing in English in the noir, typically American hardboiled style. I mean, sort of you couldn't get further away from what your father writes. It's rather interesting, I have to say.
In terms of language, I agree a lot with his position, especially for people like me who can speak Kikuyu and can write in Kikuyu, which Kikuyu is my language, is my first language. I do think as writers we have a duty to our languages. And we have been answering that question for myself slowly and over time. But for him also, he does understand the politics of trying to publish in African languages. So for him, he says, well, if you have a novel to write, don't say you won't write it until you can write it in an African language. Write the novel. It's better the novel is there, than it's not.
Yeah. So what happens to Ishmael when he goes to Africa then, when he goes to Kenya? I mean, what does he have to struggle with?
Well, now, when he goes to Kenya, he finds that the sense of justice is not what he's used to in the U.S., though he does suspect in the U.S. he has an illusion of that justice is always served. But anyway, he gets there and he finds that the violence is unmitigated by anything, So within a few hours of landing, he's in a shootout. Him and his counterpart, the Kenyan counterpart by the name of O. At the same time, issues of blackness, which he had never really, really thought of. I mean, they were always there, but he had never really, really thought of what does it mean to be black? What does it mean to be not just a black American, but black in relation to Africa?
Mm-hmm. Now, we should talk some more about O. He's sort of his fascinating character. How would you describe O?
I would describe him as a guy who has found a way of living in the normal world of having a wife who is a school teacher, So he's a guy who does like a 9-to-5 and comes home and has dinner, And
they have a very nice marriage.
And have a very nice marriage, But once he's outside the house, he can indulge in extreme violence without wincing, And like Ishmael, who still has a conscience, Ishmael vomits every time he shoots somebody. He can't stomach that violence.
Is it clear that O and Ishmael are always the good guys, that they're always on the side of justice? Or does that line get blurred?
Well, it's constantly blurred, because essentially what people like O are doing are what now Amnesty International would call extrajudicial killings, right? A few years ago, the Kenyan police were accused by the Kenya National Human Rights Commission of taking out poor young men from the slums like Mathare and taking them out to the forest and shooting them. And for the cops who are doing that, their logic was, you know, these guys are probably thieves, you know, or will be thieves, you know, some sort of preemptive justice. So that's the kind of logic that O has. And, you know, I ended up modeling O after detectives who are assigned to protect my father. As you mentioned, he's a writer. At some point, he was in political exile. And then when he went back, he was attacked. Now, the people who attacked him were put on trial. But for us to attend that trial, we had to be under police protection. So we ended up spending a lot of time, you know, with these Kenyan detectives. And through that, I was able to start understanding their duality.
Hmm. Now, what one of the conventions of the crime novel genre is that the central character, the cop, brings order into a world of disorder, you know, gives justice where there is none. Are you trying to bring order into your worlds?
No, I mean, they can't, you know. I mean, you know, with Blackstone Nairobi, I actually ended the novel with a question of why. As a way of trying to show that these characters have undertaken this journey. And yes, you know, a few things are better, you know, because they saved the day. But really, essentially all their work, and they understand it as such, is essentially a raindrop in an ocean, right? Essentially, they're swimming against the current of disorder.
Well, I'd love to end with one more passage from your second novel, Black Star Nairobi. And by this time, Ishmael has moved to Africa, and he sort of set up shop there, working in partnership with O. Could you read a passage as he's reflecting on what it's like to now be living in Africa?
Yeah, sure. I hadn't felt American for a long time. In fact, I had not wanted to. A black man from the U.S., I like getting lost in the sea of blackness in Kenya rather than standing out in a sea of whiteness in Madison, Wisconsin. But the idea that a fellow American, a black man like me, could be shot and his body left in the middle of Gong Forest to be devoured by hyenas stirred up an anger in me that I knew was dangerous. In the U.S., we died in all sorts of ways, but never like this. The body in Gong, it reminded me of English 101, Antigone. The king leaves a rebel's body to be devoured by wild beasts. It didn't end well for everyone involved. I just knew there was no coming back from this one, whatever it was.
Bukoma Wagugi is the author of Nairobi Heat and Black Star Nairobi. Steve Paulson talked with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Like a corpse that won't stay buried, this hour has a second life online. You'll find a link to the podcast and book and music listings on our website, ttbook.org. Stephanie Youngblood produced this hour with help from Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Charles Monroe Kane. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson.
PRI, Public Radio International.